Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, so hi Duncan, thank you very much for meeting us and for talking to us about your book. Really enjoyed it. We'll all be murdered in our beds. The shocking history of crime reporting in Britain. Well, I was going to start off by asking you, what's the secret of a sort of a good crime reporter, do you think? Are there any particular ingredients that make someone good at it? Or
I think you have to be curious and enjoy it, and I think you're too young to remember there used to be a police recruiting slogan which was "dull it isn't," and I think that is what most crime reporters feel about the job. What makes a good one? There's a whole mixture of people. Some people have very good police contacts, some people have very good criminal contacts, a fewer number have very good of both, and it's quite difficult to slip between it. But I think a curiosity, an openness, and an ability, I suppose, not to assume that what you're told either by a police officer or a criminal is necessarily the case.
And where did your stories come from, and do they come from? Is it from the police or from the underworld or from a mixture of both?
Well, the mixture of both. I mean, I started off, I suppose, having much better contacts with the underworld, partly because back in the 70s there was a lot of suspicion of Fleet Street. It was and that period when Ronnie Biggs got stitched up by the Daily Express, you know, that he had made a deal with them, and the Express behind his back went to the police. And I think that and other similar incidents, Walter Probyn, who was known as Angel Face, wanted to talk to the Daily Mirror and assumed that he had escaped at the time and wanted to give them his story. And they stitched him up and they told the police, and then they got a front page story in which they didn't mention that they had given him their word, as it were, that they were going to meet him and chat. So I think there was a cynicism about the Fleet Street press, and I was working at that stage in the 70s initially I was at LBC, but at Time Out magazine, which did news in those days, and therefore it was easier to have a rapport with them, because they knew that Time Out had been raided by the police on a number of occasions, and therefore they thought that we might be more sympathetic and wouldn't stitch them up.
It's interesting, you know, how the relationship between reporters and police in particular perhaps changed over the years, because you know, from my perspective at Press Gazette, it seems very, very tense at the moment, and difficult.
Yes.
I mean, what's your take on that from writing the book and from your own experience?
Well, going back to the 1950s and 60s, before I was writing, but that period, the relationship between the press and the police was very, very close. The Crime Reporters Association had this in with the officers, and if you that particular period, sometimes the crime reporters would actually drive the police to the scene of a crime if they were all drinking together in the same pub, Tom Sandrock of the Telegraph. They hung out together, they drank with the flying squad every Monday night and so on. It was very, very close. And therefore they got the inside stories on lots of big crimes and lots of tip-offs. The downside was that at that period, which was, there was a lot of corruption on the detective side, not the uniform side, I think, so much, in Scotland Yard in the 1960s, early 70s, that was cleaned up largely by Robert Mark when he became the commissioner. The downside was that they didn't cover that level of corruption. I think you now have a reverse situation, post-Leveson, post-hacking, where detectives are very reluctant to be seen having a drink with, having lunch with a reporter, and that, just talking to my contemporaries who are still, or people a bit younger than me, but people I worked with, like Martin Brunt at Sky and John Toomey at The Express and Mike Sullivan at The Sun, they will all say it is very, very difficult to establish that relationship now with police, where they feel they can meet you and explain what's going on. But they're worried that they will be then accused of leaking stuff.
And does the sort of reader and the sort of general public lose out as a result of that?
Yes, yes, I'm sure they do. You don't get the nuances and the, you know, why are they doing this? Why did they not charge this person? Why did they charge this person? Why did it take so long? Sometimes that's quite complex to explain. And if you can do that off the record with somebody who trusts you and who you trust, then it does explain things. And now, if it comes just through a press officer, there are some good press officers, but there are some bad press officers, then the public doesn't get such a good picture.
I guess obviously the thing that's really prompted this huge sort of backlash, I think, against journalists from the police is Operation Elvedon, perhaps, and the fact that the you know, lots of journalists, or well, some journalists on The Sun and The Mirror, you know, paying police officers for stories, and so, you know, the journalists themselves are arrested and police officers in some cases sent to prison. I mean, what were your sort of thoughts about that as that unfolded? I guess it's probably not something you might have done on The Guardian. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it was extraordinary seeing the way it unfolded, and it has ramifications which I don't think of, because the civil case is coming through now, which you've been reporting in Press Gazette, that, you know, I think more will emerge. And I think, you know, again, talking specifically to crime reporters, most of them were pretty shocked that that kind of stuff was going on, and also shocked that when the police finally did react, that News International, as it was then, handed over that great tranche of stuff. And I know not that many journalists have been convicted, but I think 34 sources have been convicted, including 8 police officers. So the message there is you can't necessarily know that when you contact a journalist that your email, your phone call to them might end up one day with the police. And I think that's been the other downside of it, apart from the police not being prepared to talk.
Yeah, so I suppose the potential sort of chilling effect, as people say, on sources maybe being less or reluctant to come forward now.
Yes.
I mean, just in that sort of area, the other thing that was a big story for us at Press Gazette the last couple of years was the, you know, the fact that the Met Police, you know, viewed the phone records of some journalists.
Yes.
To find the police officers who'd spoken to them.
Yes.
That game.
Yeah.
And then we found out that it was actually fairly widespread, that this goes, I think it was 81 cases in the last 3 years, or 82 cases in the last 3 years. Were you quite shocked by that, to find out that... or have you always been sort of naturally fairly cautious about that sort of thing? You know, mobiles. You know, the fact that your call records could potentially be viewed by somebody who might have found out.
Yeah, I was certainly surprised that it was so easy to get hold of stuff. And I mean, I don't think. I mean, I stopped doing daily reporting 2009, and I think it's since then that they've got more sophisticated at grabbing records. But I know certainly other crime reporters I spoke to were amazed that that level of knowing who your contacts were was possible. And I think some people are, you know, Jeff Edwards, who used to be the crime correspondent at the Mirror, told one story about meeting one of his contacts underneath a bridge, you know. And I don't know if whether or not we'll eventually have to go back to that or meet people in Turkish baths or something. But it is I think, very disturbing that anybody you talk to or email could now potentially be fingered.
Yeah. So back to the book. I mean, who is the... I was wondering who's the crime reporter you kind of found you admired the most in the book. Who's your favourite? Maybe from the history and from the current sort of...
Well, from history, I mean, W.T. Stead, who was the Pall Mall Gazette, who... extraordinary character. I think he'd make a wonderful character in a film. I mean, he was a kind of... He believed that he and God were in partnership. But he was very driven, and quite rightly, by the fact that girls as young as 13 were being used as prostitutes in London by the aristocracy and everybody else, and it was a scandal, and nobody did anything about it because they were mainly working-class girls and so on. And he went undercover and exposed this, and as a result, the age of consent was raised from 13 to 16. He went to prison and was very proud to have gone to prison. And I think he did an enormous amount of work, but he did expose a great scandal, and I think, you know, he set a kind of template. More recently, I mean, Duncan Webb, who was the people's guy, is a strange character, you know, there's all these stories about him that, you know, he worked behind a bulletproof screen in the office and had eight locks on his door and so on. And he was very close to Billy Hill, who was the boss of the underworld in the 1950s and ghosted his book. And he certainly had a very lively career, and he's credited with being the man who came up with I made my excuses and left, although there's three different people compete for that. So I think those two. And then one who's still with us, Jimmy Nicholson, the Prince of Darkness, who when I started was very friendly. I mean, a complete character that Damon Runyon could have written. So those three stand out.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What's the best story that the best sort of story you worked on, do you think?
Well, in some ways, the most interesting was the West case in the way that it unfolded, and the one with the sort of most waves. I also
Fred West and
Rose West, yeah. Yes, and the trial. And I don't know. I mean, I found the Stoke Newington corruption inquiry, which went on much longer than I would have hoped, was very informative, just in terms of sources and libel actions and so on. So I suppose those two, and then the torso murder case, which was two people who I believed were wrongly convicted of murder, and we did a lot of stuff, and I found the person who was the main witness against them, who eventually said he'd made up his evidence, and they were cleared, but they were inside for more than 20 years before they were cleared, and they then received hundreds of thousands of pounds in compensation. But that was one that I had kind of followed for more than 20 years.
Oh, wow. I mean, it strikes me that the journalists who write about crime, you know, if you write about other things, you get some nasty phone calls and maybe some grumpy letters from PRs, but if you're writing about crime, you're dealing, the stakes can be rather higher.
I mean, yes, for some people. I mean, in Britain, we're lucky, you know, compared to Mexico, Honduras, Russia, Turkey, you know, we're quite lucky. Ireland, we have had somebody killed who was turning over drug dealers. But by and large...
Martin O'Hagan, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's been... By and large, there's not been a lot of violence carried out against crime reporters here. There's various threats and so on, but I think we've been quite lucky here in that there's a feeling, I think probably among some criminals, that if you whack the press, then they really get involved, you know, so you might as well leave them alone and stick to the libel court.
You find largely intimidation is not something you kind of encountered, or
not really? No, I think. I mean, sometimes people are unhappy that you're doing a story, but I can't think of anyone who one took seriously. You know, you would get calls saying you are a dead man, and I know the way you go to work and things like that. But I always thought that people who phone up to tell you that are not going to do it, otherwise why are they telling you that? And I did have somebody ages ago who did know how I went to, he knew where I changed tubes and everything, and he was going to shoot me in the base of the spine so that I'd be paralysed and everything, and then, you know, finally we talked to our lawyers about it, and they said, well, tape record him the next time. And I just said, you do realise you've been taped, and we have to... And that was the end of it, you know. And I always thought he got more... And I think you probably know this as well as me, that people who enjoy doing that kind of stuff... Fortunately, it was before Twitter, when there's this kind of constant horrible stuff, which... you know, which you get to a certain extent when you... In the comments bit, but I... rarely read the bits underneath stuff, so it's just better not to worry.
What do you think about the sort of future of crime reporting? Is it like everything else in journalism, rather imperiled, or do you think it's looking okay?
I think it'll... I was talking to Martin Brunt about it. He was talking about how he could tell life had changed, because when he wrote the word blagger on his computer, it was changed to blogger, you know, and that was a kind of sign of how we were being overtaken by digitalization. And he was saying, and others have said, it would be very hard now as a sort of 20-something crime reporter starting. You know, 40 years ago, obviously the Guardian had... different kind of police who were interested in chatting to you, but 40 years ago people were curious about talking to journalists, and if you didn't, if they found out they could trust you, then you could have a rapport with them. I think it'd be very, very difficult now to start. Even doing this book, I spoke to a lot of ex coppers that I knew about relations with the press, and it's a history book. But I also was trying to get some current ones, and one of them, who would have been great, said, I'd love to, but I would have to have a press officer present, and we live in different times, sorry. And that was the end of the interview. I'm sure that will change. I think it's probably more in the Met than in the rest of the country. I think it's a London thing. And, you know, there will always be an interest in these, in stories, in murders, in Hatton Garden burglaries and so on. And people will find ways of doing it which we can't imagine.
Yeah. But even as you say, for a sort of for a history book, serving police officers felt it would be sort of more than their job was worth to have a conversation with you.
I know. I mean, they say we can only talk if it's about a specific case, and it just seemed, you know, the level of paranoia is such that they don't. I mean, they joke about it, but they don't like to be seen even in a canteen at the Old Bailey having a coffee with you in case somebody rats on them, and there's lots of rats around.
Well, just one quick final question then. You worked at The Guardian obviously for a long time, 20,
yes.
20 years?
23 years, yes.
And Alan Rossiter, long-serving editor there, stepped down last year. He's now stepping up to the Scott Trust, the owner of The Guardian, I think, in September. And a little bit of criticism in the Times and the FT elsewhere about his stewardship of the paper, mm-hmm. because of the losses it's seeing at the moment. But what did you think of him as an editor and someone to work with?
I thought he was terrific. I mean, my biggest kind of connection with him working was he was the editor when I got sued by 8 officers backed by the Police Federation, one of, you know, that there was their 96th action against journalists. And he decided to fight it. He decided that he would fight libel actions that he thought the Guardian perhaps, you know, should fight, that they had a case. And he fought Jonathan Aitken, he fought Neil Hamilton, and he fought the Police Federation. And those are high stakes. I mean, we were going down for 900,000 if we lost, because we had George Carman, 5,000 quid a day. There was a mistrial, and the trial started again. And Carman and the solicitors were brought into the Guardian, and Alan was there. And Carman said we were not allowed to use any evidence of stuff that had happened since I wrote my story. We couldn't talk about all the people I'd written who had been cleared of offences and given compensation, which would have, we thought, was very important, but the judge wouldn't let us. And Alan said, or the managing director at the time, said, what are our chances of winning? And Carman said, probably 1 in 4. And they said, well, it's a matter of principle, we fight on. And I would get notes right throughout the trial from Alan saying, whatever happens, we're doing the right thing, and so on. And it made an enormous difference that you felt he was completely on your side. And then, you know, and when we won, and we were able to publish everything, and he was very happy that his decision was vindicated. So from that point of view, I couldn't have asked for a more supportive editor who was not, because the Federation kept saying, well, we expect you'll settle on the steps of the court, because that was how most of those actions were ended. And I think it was, from that point of view, I was very impressed with him, that he never lost his nerve.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Duncan Campbell, thank you for coming on the Journalism Matters podcast. Great. And for the next edition, will be available for download in 2 weeks' time.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. and it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.